Tonight's discussion, of course, is with Stephen Dick, the astrophysicist, biologist, as we talk about space. Welcome back to Coast, Stephen Dick with us. Stephen, I guess it's difficult to talk about space without at least bringing in theology, religion, spirituality, in that it adds a different flavor, I think, to what science may or may not discover. Do you find it difficult to deal with these subjects without including spirituality or theology?
Without including spirituality? Well, I think, you don't need to have recourse to the supernatural. I think there's enough in terms of spirituality in the natural world. The universe is still very mysterious, but it evokes awe and wonder, and you don't need the supernatural for that. When we talk about extraterrestrial life, I think that is also true. One of the big questions in terms of extraterrestrial life is how would it affect religions on Earth? If some of us don't believe in the supernatural, billions of people on the Earth do. So it's an important question when you're talking about the impact of finding life, what these people might believe and how their religions might have to change. And of course, it's a complicated question because there are many religions on the Earth, and each one might be impacted in a different way. We like to talk mostly about Christianity in the Western world because that's what most people in the Western world adhere to. And of course, the questions there are really quite large in terms of the doctrines of Christianity. If you have extraterrestrial intelligence out there, you have to have a planet hopping Jesus in terms of incarnation and redemption and that sort of thing? Those are questions that have been asked over the last few decades, even in the course of the last few centuries. You can trace those kinds of arguments, and people come up with different answers, of course. Some people think that religions, Christianity in particular, wouldn't be affected that much. They would have to adopt, but they have adopted in the past various things, so they probably would adopt to this. And other people think that, could be the demise of religion because, this idea of a planet-hopping savior is pretty pretty severe. We had in our symposium a Jesuit speak on the subject, would you baptize an extraterrestrial, which garnered a lot of interest. And his answer was, only if it asked, which I thought was quite an improvement from when the Europeans first made contact with the Americas, when they were forcing the Native Americans to convert. So this raises all kinds of questions in terms of theology and religion.
I find it personally difficult to think of science without thinking of some kind of spirituality behind it. I don't know what it is. I have no idea really what it is, how it was, why it was created, but when I sometimes just look at mankind and, here we are doing what we do, you and I talking on a national radio show, people going to work in the morning, carrying their briefcases, to me, there's got to be much more than just bricks and mortar, basically, of creation caused by just pure science. There's just got to be something else out there. Maybe we'll find it one day, Stephen.
Well, it depends how you define what else is out there.
Yeah.
You can think in terms of if you want to talk about, a God or something that that approaches God, you don't necessarily have to talk about the supernatural. You could talk about very advanced extraterrestrials. After all, if you have extraterrestrials that have been around for a million or a billion years, they might approach what we think of as God. They may be omnipotent and omniscient and that sort of thing. So you could have a kind of what I would call a cosmotheology, a theology based on not the supernatural, but just what has happened in the normal course of evolution. It's still all very mysterious. We don't know the answers, but it's fun to contemplate them.
Well, I think that's exactly what probably has happened, that extraterrestrials of incredible ability and time spent have probably circled the universe in any way they know how to travel. Maybe they're bending space and time And they're seeding other planets with the technology that they have now had. But to me, it still doesn't answer the question, how they get here.
Well, that's right. That's always the question. And of course, you could say, if you say God did it, then you have to ask, well, where did God come from? So that doesn't help a whole lot either.
That's right. That is absolutely true. It is mind-boggling. I mean, is it something that just makes you shake your head trying to discover this answer, or do you just move on?
Well, I think there's plenty of room for mystery and awe in the universe, and certainly I think astronomers, and myself included, you know, when you contemplate the night skies, I grew up in rural southern Indiana seeing all those stars. And it just generates this feeling of awe and mystery, and you want to find out more and more about it. Science does that to some extent, but I think we do need to be careful to say that science is not all there is. There are problems can't be approached by science, and so I think there is a place for religion and theology in terms of the good side. Of course, religion and theology have a history in the past of also generating a lot of problems, but I think we have to leave open the possibility that there is more to the universe than just science.
I would be remiss if I didn't talk to you about how you think the universe started. The Big Bang Theory is still confusing to me, Stephen.
Well, it's the going theory, the Big Bang Theory, the origin of the universe, that it started, and the spacecraft now, the latest spacecraft, the Cosmic Background Explorer a few years ago, and what's called the WMAP spacecraft, and most recently the Planck spacecraft, the European spacecraft, have all shown the observations that were expected to be seen if the Big Bang were true. Of course, the problem always is, well, what happened before the Big Bang?
and what was before the Big Bang?
Exactly, what was before the Big Bang. And there you can get into some theories about what's called the multiverse, you know, that there are many universes. And we're just one of the many universes that exist. And this is where you get into, you get into things like the movie Interstellar, where you have wormholes and black holes and baby universes being born and that sort of thing, which is all still pretty speculative. I mean, we know that black holes exist. We're not so sure if wormholes exist for interstellar travel. But, it is all still very mysterious, but the Big Bang is the best theory we have going right now.
And let's talk about that theory for a moment. What do you think happened based on the Big Bang? Can you kind of explain it to us so we can understand it a little bit better?
Well, as I say, it's virtually certain now based on the scientific observations that the Big Bang occurred 13.8 billion years ago. It emerged from what's called a singularity. And the theory these days is that there was what's called an inflationary universe, that the universe went from a single, almost just a point, and expanded extremely fast in the first few seconds. What we see now is the remnants of that expansion. It's still expanding now. In fact, we know it's not only expanding. One of the great results of the last decade have been to show that it's actually accelerating in that expansion. And we would have thought that it might be slowing down because, you know, in the same way, it just makes sense that if you have an explosion and things are hurled sort of outwards, that things would slow down after a while. But for some reason, they're accelerating. And this is where you get into these mysterious things like dark energy and dark matter. So there's a lot that's still not known about the Big Bang, but as I say, it is the best thing that we have going. And all of space science, all of the spacecraft that NASA has, and the Europeans have, and the other countries have, are ways of filling in this scenario of the Big Bang, which is unfolded over the last 13.8 billion years. You know, when you're observing galaxies or stars or whatever, you're filling in this story. You might call it almost Genesis for the 21st century. Based on what science knows, you're filling in this story about the Big Bang and the unfolding of the cosmos over the last 13.8 billion years.
And this acceleration of the universe, one would think, okay, what's it accelerating into? or it's already there. So what's happening there? How do you accelerate into nothing?
Yeah, it's difficult to understand, and I'm sure not sure that I can explain it very well myself. The model that's usually used is like a balloon blowing up, although that's not a very good model because the balloon you can see is expanding into the space around it. But it's best to consider yourself on the surface of the balloon, and everything around you is expanding. If you put dots on that balloon, they're getting further and further apart on that balloon. And so in that way, the universe is expanding, but it doesn't help to visualize what it's expanding into. I think people would say that's just the wrong question to ask, which isn't a very satisfactory answer, but that's the way it is.
Let's talk more about the multiverses, Stephen. Were you a believer in them when they started talking about this theory?
Well, the reason the multiverse arose is because of this what's called the fine-tuning problem. In other words, a lot of the constants in the universe seem to be fine-tuned for life. If the cosmological constant or the gravitational constant weren't just right, you wouldn't have stars form. If you didn't have stars form, of course, you wouldn't have planets. So the question is, why do we see this universe that seems to be fine-tuned for life? And so one answer is that we just live in one universe that happens to be fine-tuned for life. There are lots of other universes out there which are called the multiverse, which don't have constants that are favorable for life. So in that sense, it does answer a conundrum, but the problem is that it's very difficult to prove. I don't think you can prove the multiverse, which by definition is you can't observe. You can't prove that any more than you can prove the existence of God. So you have the same problem as as you do with proving the existence of God if you're trying to prove the existence of the multiverse, because, as I say, by definition, you cannot observe another universe.
If you could get one question answered about the universe that you're seeking, what would that question be? What would you want to know?
What will be the end fate of the universe? We do know some things about that in terms of we know, how long our star is going to live. The sun is about 5 billion years old. It's got another 5 billion years to go. We know a lot about stellar evolution, but we don't know a whole lot about how the universe is going to end, except that it will be a long time. Some of those dwarf stars that I mentioned earlier, those red dwarfs, will last trillions of years. So it would seem that, eventually the lights will go out in the universe, and that we happen to be in a period here where life is possible. So in terms of life, my question would be, what is the place of life in the universe? What is the ultimate fate and destiny of life in the universe? And, what is it all going to amount to in the end?
I used to panic as a kid, Stephen, when our physics teacher would tell us that the star had a life to it and one day it would die out. And I used to go home all upset. I'd talk to my folks and I'd say, the sun's going to burn out. And, my dad kept saying, George, that's 5 billion years from now. Don't worry about it. It took me a long time to really grasp that.
Well, I find the same thing when I talk to school groups, especially elementary school. you say that the sun is going to only last another 5 billion years. Of course, they don't have much of a concept of what 5 billion years is. But one told me that he said, "Oh, I thought you said 5 million years. Like you should worry if it's 5 million years." You know, I mean, that's really long-term thinking, long-term worry. Worry there. I think we have other things to worry about before the sun dies.
Can you tell us a little bit more about dark matter, what it is, and what you think its purpose is?
Well, dark matter is distinct from dark energy. The universe that we see, the visible universe that we see, really we now know is only about 4% of the entire universe, contents of the universe of matter and energy. The rest of it is dark matter and dark energy. We know about the dark energy because of this acceleration of the universe, that this dark, something that we call dark energy, which we have no idea what it is, must exist for the universe to be accelerating. Now, the dark matter is quite a different thing. Dark matter, we know exists because when they look at galaxy rotations out there, they're not rotating according to the Kepler's laws as they should be. They're rotating as if there were more mass than just the luminous visible mass that we see. So that's why they think there must be a dark energy, or dark matter out there to be making that effect visible. So the problem there is we still don't know exactly what the dark matter is. Is it matter that has not ignited to stars yet? Is it just a lot of interstellar or intergalactic dust, which, you know, if you have enough of it, can be a large part of the mass of the universe? They just don't know yet what the dark matter is.
I mean, if you were in a spaceship, could you collide into it?
Well, it depends what it is. If it's stars that haven't ignited, you could collide into it. If it's just interstellar or intergalactic gas, you would be going through it. You know, it could be very sparse, but given the massive area around any particular galaxy, it could also be very massive. So you wouldn't. I think you could go if it were interstellar gas or dust. You could be going through it with your spaceship without damage to the spaceship.
So if there were stars out there that had not ignited, but the mass of the star was there, would you not be able to see it still in some form or fashion with a telescope? Or is it perfectly, in appearance, you wouldn't see it?
Well, there are these things called brown dwarfs, which are indeed stars that have not quite ignited. They don't have nuclear fusion going on.
Well, not ignited, or they burned out?
They're not ignited.
Okay.
They don't have the mass to ignite. Nuclear fusion. So they found these beginning in about 1995, and you can tell just from a very you can find them just by a very faint glow, or you can find them by their effect on other nearby objects. But they don't glow as with nuclear fusion as a regular star does. So if there are a lot of those out there, they could account for at least some of the dark matter, the missing mass that we can't see. We see a few of them, but wouldn't see most of them.
I guess it would be kind of eerie if you were in a spaceship and you kind of came upon these unignited dwarfs.
Yes, I'd like to do that sometime, but that would be quite abrupt if you wouldn't see them, wouldn't see them coming. But hopefully your spaceship would have some mass detection mechanism so you could so you wouldn't run into them.
You'd know. What fascinates you the most about the universe, Stephen? What's out there?
Well, I have to say just what we've been talking about, the whether or not there's life. There are two or three possibilities. Three really. That the universe is a physical universe where you have where cosmic evolution that we've been talking about ends up in matter, galaxies and planets and stars. Or you could have a biological universe, which is the title of one of my books, The Biological Universe, where cosmic evolution commonly ends in life and intelligence. Or a third possibility is that you have this post-biological universe that I mentioned before, where you have the not only evolution of life and intelligence, but the evolution of culture beyond, and that this culture has gone beyond flesh and blood to invent artificial intelligence, which may then have taken over from biological intelligence. So you
let's
might
talk
have
a little. Let's talk a little bit about that and ET life when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Stephen Dick with us. Stephen, you were telling us that you testified before Congress. What did they want to know? What were they looking for?
Well, of course, Congress funds NASA, and part of that is astrobiology. So what they were doing in general is trying to find out what the latest results were in astrobiology. It turns out this was before the House Science Committee, and the chair of the House Science Committee, Lamar Smith from Texas, is very interested in astrobiology. So they were asking about what the latest results were in astrobiology, and also what the implications might be if we find life. And of course, Congress makes policy, and so they were interested in what policies already in place for the discovery of life and what policies we might put in place. So that's what I was testifying about.
Do we have a policy in place now, either at the United Nations level or here in the United States, in the event that we're visited by some extraterrestrials and they want to, you know, speak to the president or somebody?
No, not at the United Nations level. There is a policy, a short-term policy, both for microbial life and for intelligent life. NASA has what are called the Planetary Protection Protocols. They have a pretty robust program in that. They have a planetary protection officer. In other words, you want to, in terms of microbes, you want to make sure that you don't contaminate what you're looking for on Mars, for example, and you certainly want to make sure that you don't back-contaminate if you buy some, bring some materials back to the Earth. So there's that planetary protection program, but that's for the very short term. And then in terms of intelligent life, there are what are called post-detection protocols, which basically boil down to if you find something, then confirm it first and then tell everybody. But beyond that, there really is not very much. Now, those SETI protocols that I mentioned have been approved at the level of international scientific organizations like the International Academy of Astronautics and the International Astronomical Union, but not at the level of the United Nations. So there's a lot of work that still needs to be done, I think, both in terms of microbes and intelligent life for the longer-term impact of what we would do if we found life. And I think there's where you need sort of an interdisciplinary group similar to the one that I gathered at the Library of Congress to actually deliberate. That was not our purpose at the Library of Congress to deliberate on policy, but I think that's what you would want, not just a single person coming up with policy, but a group of scholars, interdisciplinary scholars, who would tackle this problem.
I was at a UFO conference last month near Las Vegas, and we had an opportunity to watch a short film called Stranger at the Pentagon by Craig Campobasso. And it's an incredible story, Stephen. It was written primarily by author Frank Stranges. He's no longer with us anymore. But his story was that there was a universal envoy, some chap by the name of Valiant Thor, who met with President Eisenhower and others in 1957 to try to convince them to do some incredible things. And I guess it just didn't work out. But what a great story, even to think about those possibilities, like, you know, the day the Earth, just those are great movies.
Oh, the day the Earth stood still. There are some great science fiction movies having to do with this subject. And you know, all the Star Wars movies, and certainly through the 1950s and up to the present, you see that in popular culture. And I think one of the interesting things to me, at least, is that this is pervasive in Western culture, but you don't see it so much in Eastern cultures. And I don't know what that says. I think that'd be a great research topic. Why is this? Why are we almost obsessed with this idea of extraterrestrial life in Western culture, whereas Eastern cultures don't seem to be so interested, including Eastern religions? You know, it's certainly pervasive in Western culture. There's a nice popular book on this subject by Washington Post reporter Joel Achenbach called Captured by Aliens. And he means by that the popular mind in the West has been captured by aliens. But why it should be only the West and not the East, I think, is a great question.
And do you think they're believers in the East, or they just don't care?
You know, I just don't know. I don't know that research has been done on that. I'm sure there are UFO reports and that sort of thing from the East, but I think it's just not nearly as much a part of their popular culture as it is in the United States and the Western world in general.
So where do you go next, Stephen? What's on your agenda these days?
Well, I'm finishing two books. One is the proceedings of that Library of Congress meeting, and that is called The Impact of Discovering Life Beyond Earth. And then I'm finishing my own book. That book I just mentioned is, of course, 21 different authors from around the world on all these different subjects. And then my own book is going to be called, at least the working title is Cosmic Encounters, How Discovering Life Beyond Earth Will Transform Our Thinking. So with those two books should keep me busy in the next year.
Do you think if they announced that we have found intelligent life elsewhere, out there, not necessarily it's here, but we know it's out there, you think people could handle it? I mean, Winston Churchill once said there was a UFO case back during World War II, and Churchill said, we will not disclose this. It was a pretty good case. What was the object? Who knows? But he was concerned that it would destroy governments and religions. I don't think that would happen anymore. Do you?
No, I would agree with that. I think people would cope one way or another. Of course, it very much depends, again, on the scenario, because even with the intelligent life scenario, you know, you could get what's called a dial tone, in other words, a radio signal, which you can prove is of extraterrestrial origin and is artificial. It's not just from a natural radiation from a star or something like that. But then it depends on whether you know, if there's a message in there, whether you can decipher the message, and then the reaction would also depend on what the message said. So it very much depends on that. But even in that case, in that latter case where there's a message and it says something, I don't think people would panic unless because the stars are so far away. Even the nearest one is 4.5 light years away, and likely this would be even much further away than that, unless they said something like, we're coming to get you, but something like that. That's more of a science fiction scenario, but probably not very likely, I think. So I think people would, still go about their business and go to work every day, and whether or not their worldview would be changed, that's another thing that I've been looking at, in the long-term impact. Maybe this would be similar to, for example, the reception of the Copernican theory or the Darwinian theory, you know, which I think have changed people's worldview, that we're not central in the universe anymore, but maybe only in a subtle way. You know, they're not running around, we're not central in the universe, and they're all worried about that anymore, but it changes their worldview in terms of where we fit in the universe and in cosmic evolution, but it doesn't affect their daily lives all that much.
Stephen Hawking says we should be very wary of sending out signals announcing who we are and where we are.
Yes, that's right. I just saw the movie about Stephen Hawking, The Theory of Everything, very, very moving movie, I thought.
Yeah.
But I think, he may not be correct in that because, for one thing, I don't think we can hide, I don't like the scenario that we are sort of crouching here on Earth, hiding from what's out there. I don't think we can help ourselves. I mean, maybe curiosity will kill the cat, but I doubt it. We have to. This whole process of finding life is part of exploration, and we're a curious species, so we're going to explore, and we'll just have to see what happens. I mean, it's possible, that the worst scenarios of science fiction will come true, but I tend to be more on the optimistic side.
So tell me a little bit more about this possibility of artificial intelligence in the future on some of these far-out planets. I would agree with you that if it's evolving, that they probably have incredible technology.
Well, right. The idea there, the driving force there, is that if you take evolution seriously, there's the famous Drake equation, which basically has as its, which is the number of technological civilizations in the galaxy which are communicating. But aside from the various parameters in there, what they really represent is cosmic evolution in terms of astronomical evolution, biological evolution, and cultural evolution. And usually the last one is not talked about much because astronomers and biologists don't know much about cultural evolution. But what we know for sure is that cultural evolution does occur on the Earth. So anywhere that you have culture, you will have cultural evolution. And so I wrote a paper on what I call the post-biological universe, saying that any society that can improve itself or can improve its intelligence will improve its intelligence, just because otherwise they'll be left behind. And so if that is what I call the intelligence principle, if that is the driving force for cultural evolution, then civilizations will always be trying to improve the intelligence of their members. And what we think of in terms of today is that would be machine intelligence, artificial intelligence, resulting in the post-biological universe. Now, of course, there are some people philosophers who think that what's called strong AI, strong artificial intelligence, is not possible. It's not possible to make intelligence that exceeds human intelligence.
I'm not sure about that.
That may be true in the short term here on the Earth, but if you've got civilizations out there that are millions of years older, it seems to me that if it's possible at all, that it would have happened.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look at our advance in the past 100 years. Look at our advance.
Right.
The technology that got us to the moon, we have far surpassed. I mean, we've got more firepower in our smartphones than those Apollo missions had.
Mm-hmm. So if you expand that to civilizations that are much older than ours, you just don't know what they would be. I think the weakness of the post-biological argument is may not be far out enough. Maybe they've gone something beyond post-biological. I don't know what that would be, but based on the current paradigm, I think it would be machine intelligence. And then you have to ask, if the SETI programs are looking for intelligence, how would you search differently if it's machine intelligence? For one thing, it might not be on a planet, like ours. It wouldn't have to be on a planet with conditions similar to ours, because
That's
if
right.
you're machine intelligence, you could be off planet roaming the universe or something like that. And so I think it raises interesting practical questions for SETI.
Well, with Stephen Deck, astrophysicist, astrobiologist, you have talked about cosmotheology. What would change where we are today to have people talking about that?
Yeah, I think I've written an article on cosmotheology. This goes back almost 20 years ago now, when I was involved with the Templeton Foundation, which does have dialogue between, or encourages dialogue between, science and religion. And so cosmotheology for me means that you just, the theologies take into account what we know about the universe. In other words, that we are not central in any physical sense, certainly, and we're probably not central in any biological sense. And so what does that mean for our current religions and theologies? I think if we find life beyond Earth, that it may well change our religions to some extent, but and that we need to be thinking about that ahead of time. In fact, there's a growing little field called astrotheology. A number of theologians are working in that. There have been papers written about astrotheology and what the implications are for religion if we find life. And we mentioned some of those earlier in terms of Christianity. And some of the Eastern religions would be a different impact, I think. Maybe not as much of an impact, because they don't so much have the idea of redemption and incarnation. Buddhism, for example, is more just in tune with the universe itself, which is not a problem if you have extraterrestrials out there. So I think there's going to be a lot of talk in the future, more talk about astrotheology and cosmotheology, and that's one of the great interesting things about the implications of finding life.
Are your colleagues tuned in with your work? Do they agree with you, or do they not?
Oh, we argue about it all the time in terms of in terms of the implications. There's a lot of work that's been done on astrobiology in terms of the science, but there's not been a lot of work done on what the implications are. So I think it's very it's insightful for NASA to actually fund this work on looking at the implications, in the same way that other sciences like the Human Genome Project have funded the programs on the ethical, legal, and societal impact of what the Human Genome Project has done. So it's important to think about this, and people have asked me, why not wait until we discover life and talk about it then? Well, you might as well ask, why not wait until Ebola comes here and then think about it? I think it's not that we don't want to compare Ebola, astrobiology, with Ebola, but I think it's a good idea to think about these things ahead of time. And the goal would be to minimize any bad effects and maximize the good effects if we do discover life.
All right, stay with us, Stephen. We're going to come back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM, and we're going to take some phone calls with you in our final hour. His website, of course, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. By the way, don't forget to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, all of that you can get to by going to our website, coasttocoastam.com.